It's Tuesday, February 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, tentative hope builds for a ceasefire in Syria. Britain ponders leaving the European Union.
Especially with the political furor over Justice Scalia's death and eventual replacement, it's looking less and less likely that they'll be filled anytime soon.
U.S. political battles extend beyond selecting a new Supreme Court justice. Also ahead, the economics of Zimbabwe, diamonds, oil, and U.S. financial markets, and the popular duo of country music and blues, all on today's International Edition. The urgency of ending the war in Syria was underscored Sunday following multiple suicide bombings in Damascus and Homs that killed nearly 150 people and wounded about 200 others. The attacks were claimed by the Islamic State. The latest suffering came as U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry announced in Amman, Jordan, a provisional agreement with Russia on terms of a cessation of hostilities.
We are closer to a ceasefire today than we have been, and I take nothing for granted about this. A cessation of hostilities, a hudna, is possible over the course of these next hours. I spoke with Foreign Minister Lavrov by phone. I underscored the urgent need to achieve a full cessation of hostilities in the shortest time frame possible. And I believe that in the conversation that we had, we have reached a provisional agreement.
And then Monday came a joint statement. The U.S. and Russia proposed that the ceasefire begin February 27th. VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins joins us with more details on this updated agreement.
Well, this flowed out of the initial plan that the International Syria Support Group reached in Munich earlier this month. And the group set up a ceasefire task force that is being led by the U.S. and Russia. And the group initially hoped to have a cessation of hostilities in place by this past Friday. They, of course, missed that deadline. The fighting has continued, and now there's word of this new plan. And under this plan, the ceasefire would begin on February 27th. It would not include terrorist entities such as the Islamic State and al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda affiliate. The U.S. and Russia said the plan calls for setting up what they called a communication hotline that would help promote and sustain the ceasefire. But a lot of the other details still need to be ironed out. State Department spokesman Mark Toner said that he fully expects more details to come out over the next few days on how this ceasefire will be monitored. The initial plan indicates that there will be a lot of reliance on groups such as NGOs and journalists in Syria to provide feedback on who's being hit and also on possible ceasefire violations.
How confident are U.S. officials that those groups will be able to relay detailed and timely information regarding the effectiveness of the deal?
There seems to be cautious optimism on the U.S. side at this point because there are still some provisions of the agreement that they need to work out. Now, Secretary of State Kerry and his Russian counterpart, Foreign Minister Lavrov, have been holding a series of talks on this. Kerry has also been meeting with other members of the International Syria Support Group. He spoke today with his British, French, and Turkish counterparts. And over the past weekend, of course, he was in Jordan and met with Nasser Judeh in Amman. So officials are taking a cautious approach on going forward as they continue to look at ways to fully implement this plan and also some of the monitoring mechanisms.
President Obama and Russian President Vladimir Putin discussed the agreement. What did they have to say in public about it?
They spoke by phone on the issue, and the White House released a statement. It said that Obama emphasized that the priority now is to ensure a positive response from the Syrian government and the opposition, and also to make sure that all of the parties involved implement the ceasefire. Also, White House spokesman Josh Earnest weighed in. He admitted that the ceasefire would be difficult to implement, and he said he expected there would be obstacles and setbacks. But he also called it a moment of opportunity and said he hopes that all of the parties could capitalize on it.
It has been a very busy day at the State Department. For VOA correspondent Pam Dawkins, Pam, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Time now to check with our social media correspondent, G. Abby Lee. She's right here in the studio to bring us the buzz on Twitter. Hi, G.
Hello, Jim.
We just heard from Pam. Who else is discussing this on social media?
Many U.S. government Twitter accounts are talking about it, from the U.S. Embassy in Syria to the White House. The White House National Security Council, or the NSC, shared a readout of President Obama's call with his Russian counterpart, and the NSC is on Twitter at NSC44. Secretary of State John Kerry also sent out two tweets about the latest decision. He wrote, "He's gratified to see final agreements concluded for ending hostilities in Syria." He added, "If adhered to, cessation will lead to decline in violence, expanded delivery of urgently needed humanitarian supplies to #SupportSyrians.
Well, I'm sure he got some replies. Did he get some interesting ones to those tweets?
He actually did. So the most liked response was asking him why he isn't running for president. A user from Uganda wrote, "Even Uganda needs help. Secretary, #HelpUganda. But going back to the Syria topic, one of the comments asked if this ceasefire is going to be like the Iran deal. And if we're looking into the public opinions on Russia, we have to check out the country's state-owned RT.
Agreed. What are they tweeting?
It tweeted, "Russia and the U.S. are going to work together to determine non-terror groups in Syria." One user had a question about the relationship between Washington and Moscow. Of course, people are also talking about Turkey's involvement. That's all for me today. Jim?
Well, thanks for the update, G, and you may follow her on Twitter at G Abby Lee. To follow me, just look up at VOA Stevenson, and our program stream may be followed at VOA_IE. British Prime Minister David Cameron is continuing his bid to gather political support for his agreement with the European Union to stay within the 28-member bloc. While Mr. Cameron has the support of most of his cabinet, an influential conservative, London Mayor Boris Johnson, has defected to the so-called Leave campaign, or Brexit, which seeks to win voter approval in a June 23rd reference on ending Britain's 43-year membership in the EU. The 51-year-old former journalist, writing in the Daily Telegraph, said the EU has morphed and grown in such a way as to unrecognizable. European analyst Ben Wellings of Australia's Monash University told VOA's Victor Beatty the Johnson defection is a blow to Mr. Cameron's effort to maintain Britain in the EU.
Up until now, the Vote Leave campaign has been split between two major competing elements, both vying for the same goal but with different personalities who can't work with each other. Those major British politicians who've signed up to vote to leave the European Union so far have perhaps not had a kind of the charismatic appeal that might be necessary in a referendum. But Boris Johnson has that charismatic appeal. And he is the kind of politician that voters in the United Kingdom, especially England, warm to. And he is the kind of politician that voters listen to. So his announcement that he would join the campaign to leave the European Union is a major blow to David Cameron, and it's a major boost to the Leave campaign.
Well, Ben, he says he's not going to take part in the debate against members of his own party.
No, I think there's a risk here that the Conservative Party could become too divided on this. The ruling Conservative Party in the United Kingdom is split over the issue of whether to leave the European Union or remain in it. And I think that Johnson's got an eye to the future, where he has been touted as a potential successor to David Cameron, because David Cameron pledged in the election last year that he would stand down at the end of his second term. So we are thinking ahead as to who might lead the Conservative Party. And of course, a referendum splits parties down the middle usually. And Boris Johnson might want to be seen to be a consensus candidate once this business of the referendum has been finalised in June.
Well, Ben, a latest poll says one-third of voters surveyed said Mayor Johnson would be important in helping them decide which way to vote.
Yes, he is certainly a very influential politician. Even though he's best known for being Mayor of London, he is a member of Parliament as well. He is charismatic, he's political theatre, he does unconventional things. But people do listen to him, and this might sway some undecided voters, of whom there are still a good 15 or 20%, and that could really sway the vote one way or another.
Is Mayor Johnson's opposition because of the deal that came out of Brussels?
Partly. On the other hand, Boris Johnson has been a critic of the European Union since at least 1989, when he went there as a journalist to cover its activities. It's not necessarily surprising that he's come out in favour of leaving the European Union. On the other hand, he was the last major political figure to decide which way to go. And so some people might sort of say, well, why did it take him so long to make his mind up? Clearly, he wanted to look at the deal that was made after the negotiations last week and has decided that now it is actually time to vote to leave the EU.
Ben Wellings adds the Leave campaign still has the uphill battle to convince a majority of Britons to vote yes to exit the EU. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This is VOA's International Edition. Zimbabwe's government has ordered 9 diamond mining companies to stop operations and leave their premises within 90 days. Sebastian Mofu has more from Harare for VOA.
Zimbabwe Mines Minister Walter Chidakwa says officials from the affected mines operating near the Mozambique border had declined to be part of a consolidated diamond mining company formed last year by the government. He said President Robert Mugabe's government had not renewed the company's licenses.
Since they no longer hold title, these companies were notified this morning to cease all mining activities with immediate effect. They have been given 90 days within which to remove their equipment and other valuables.
There was no immediate comment from any company official. But Harare-based independent economist John Robertson said in a telephone interview, the announcement confirmed that Zimbabwe's laws, being unpredictable, were still far from being friendly to investors. Zimbabwe officially started mining diamonds in 2009. According to the minister, the companies, largely foreign-owned, had contributed $637 million to Zimbabwe's economy. Chidakwa also said all mining in the Southern African nation would be under Zimbabwe Consolidated Diamond Company, which would have a 50% government equity in line with the country's indigenization policy. In 2007, Zimbabwe introduced indigenization, which stipulates foreign businesses cede majority control to black Zimbabweans. Mugabe says the law is meant to bring into the economy blacks who had been marginalized during colonial rule. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Well, from diamonds to oil, the black gold, they call it, the world's been closely following those prices, and now U.S. stock markets and oil prices have made strong gains. On Monday, they recovered some of the value they lost during the past year and a half. Our markets reporter in New York, Jill Malandrino, tells us what's behind the positive market trend that's continuing from last week.
Well, it's nice to see after the dismal January 2016 that we traded through, February's actually positive on the month as it stands right now. Just looking at the action on Monday, crude oil is up 6% on the day and has surged from that $26-ish low that we've seen. That definitely has something to do with the bullish action that we've seen in the market. To a lesser extent, we're starting to see participation from the financial sector, which in my mind is even more key than oil providing a bid back into the market. There is a lot of uncertainty within the financials because of all of the currency moves that we've seen, a lot of the central bank policy shift that has occurred occurred over the past 6 weeks. And of course, we're going to see some more jockeying coming into that when we go into the March FOMC meeting. So I like what we're seeing in oil. We did get the participation in banks. I think what's even more important is if we see sector rotation out of utilities, if we see sector rotation out of defensive names and back into consumer discretionary, back in technology. And really the key is going to be not a bounce in financials, but investing in fresh cash back into financials.
VOA's Jill Malandrino in New York. Thank you. Of interest around the world is perhaps a rare facet of the U.S. political system as the partisan fight over a U.S. Supreme Court vacancy burst onto the Senate floor Monday. Lawmakers disagreed sharply on whether President Barack Obama should nominate a replacement for Justice Antonin Scalia, who died 9 days earlier. The chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Republican Chuck Grassley, argued that presidential election years are inappropriate for considering high court nominations. Democratic Minority Leader Harry Reid described the Republican argument as an unprecedented attempt to hold hostage an entire branch of government. The White House says it is vetting potential Supreme Court picks and that President Obama is reaching out to senators to urge full consideration of the eventual nominee. Meanwhile, another similar political stalemate has been lingering in relative obscurity. International Business Times financial writer Owen Davis joins us to explain what has been happening with two other very important vacancies.
The SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the top financial regulator in the United States, has had two vacancies for the entirety of 2016. Normally, it takes a month or two to fill these vacancies, but in the current political climate, and especially with the political furor over Justice Scalia's death and eventual replacement, it's looking less and less likely that they'll be filled anytime soon. And the importance of that is that there's still rulemaking to be done around the 2010 Dodd-Frank Act, and there's still a number of enforcement matters. There are always enforcement matters that the SEC has to consider. So between those two things, having just three commissioners on the five-commissioner commission really raises some issues for the SEC.
It is an odd number. I know that is an issue with the Supreme Court, where right now we have a 4-4 situation for justices. Is a three-member situation okay? Can the SEC function that way? Or do they really need these other two commissioners?
The SEC's rules allow it to function with just three commissioners. During the Clinton administration, they actually functioned for a number of months with just two commissioners. But the issue is that if anyone recuses, the chair, Mary Jo White, has had a pattern of recusing, then there's just two commissioners left. And with just two commissioners, if they split, then nothing happens. There's a fear that in the partisan political climate right now, that when a recusal occurs, nothing will move forward.
The Securities and Exchange Commission obviously is a regulatory body, and given the current financial climate and instability in some markets around the world, fluctuations here in the United States, how has that impacted the SEC's ability to enforce?
Well, the SEC has a long-running project to try to get what it calls a consolidated audit trail, which would follow basically every trade that happens in public equity markets. So it can look back and see when there's some unusual event like the flash crashes that have occurred a few times since 2010, what is the culprit? And especially in times of great volatility, that sort of system would be of great help in determining, what's behind weird market moves. Unfortunately, that has been delayed for a number of years, and you can only imagine that with only three of five commissioners currently on board, that sort of effort will be even more delayed.
Are there names for new commissioners that are floating out there right now?
Yeah, there are actually two commissioners have been nominated by President Obama, Republican and Democrat. The Democrat, Lisa Fairfax, has the backing of folks like Senator Elizabeth Warren, who's a big financial regulation hawk. Hester Pierce is the Republican nominee, and she actually used to work for Richard Shelby, who's the senator and the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee. So people who watch the SEC consider these two nominees to be both well-qualified and to be pretty palatable for the Senate, for both Republicans and Democrats, given that there's one of each following tradition. But the issue is the Senate committee hasn't advanced any of the 16 nominees who have been put before it since the beginning of last year. So you have going on 18 months now, you know, more than a dozen nominees who just haven't moved, and that's part of the issue here, is that with continuing political wrangling over the Supreme Court replacement, people are wondering whether this SEC nomination fight is going to take a back seat.
Following it for us is Owen Davis, International Business Times Wall Street and finance reporter. Owen, thanks so much for taking the time to explain this to us.
Thank you.
A fascinating example of how U.S. democracy works and sometimes doesn't work. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. Well, if you've listened to music coming out of the United States for some time, you probably know that country and blues are closely intertwined. The icon, Hank Williams Sr., one of country music's most influential singer-songwriters, was first taught how to play the blues at 8 years old by one of his first mentors, blues musician Rufus Payne. So it was no surprise that at the 2016 Grammy Awards, turned up two of country music superstars to pay tribute to blues legend B.B. King. VOA Music's Nikki Strong speaks with International Edition's Sarah Williams about how it all came together.
Nikki, how did Chris Stapleton get chosen to do the B.B. King tribute at the Grammys?
Well, the L.A. Times reported that the executive producer of the Grammys telecast, Ken Ehrlich, saw a YouTube performance of Chris Stapleton singing The Thrill Is Gone, and he heard his vocals and was like, you know, that's the guy. I want him to perform. So he reached out to Stapleton, and he gave him the option of doing one of his own songs or doing the B.B. King tribute. And Chris Stapleton was like, B.B. King, of course. And he said secretly that's what he enjoys and wanted to do, the blues. It was a great opportunity for him. And he also said B.B. King's guitar was on stage at their performance as well.
Oh, wow. That's incredible. Well, and also B.B. King being from the Delta in Mississippi.
Exactly.
There's that very similar. Yeah.
Yes.
So how did Bonnie Raitt get involved?
Chris Stapleton suggested it. He was like, hey, you know, Mr. Ehrlich, can you call up Bonnie and get her on board? And that's exactly what Ken did. And it happened. So it was at Chris Stapleton's suggestion, and they did a great job together on stage, along with the dynamic Gary Clark Jr. I think the performance is really fantastic, and I posted it on our Facebook page at VOA Music.
Tell us about Gary Clark Jr.
Okay, so Gary Clark Jr., he's an award-winning blues and electric guitarist. He's a singer as well. He's an actor. He was nominated for the Grammy Award for Best Rock Song in 2013. And then in 2014, he won the Grammy Award for Best Traditional R&B Performance. And then in 2014 and 2015, he won a Blues Music Award for Best Contemporary Blues Male Artist of the Year. So he's described as a blues rock artist, but his music, as you can tell from his awards, is informed by many different styles, including rock and soul and country and even hip hop and jazz. His latest project, The Story of Sonny Boy Slim, just sat in the number one spot on the Billboard Blues album chart. If you like Bonnie Raitt and Chris Stapleton and just good guitar playing and sweet singing, Gary Clark Jr. will fit nicely in your collection. And that's why the tribute was also so great. He added another dimension. And he is the youngest of the three who did the Grammys tribute, but I think the trajectory of his career is just as great, and they all stand on the shoulders of B.B. King. And he said that he wouldn't be where he was if it wasn't for B.B. King. And he said his first introduction to slide guitar was actually Bonnie great.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's amazing. So there were all three Grammy winners on stage paying tribute to legend B.B. King.
Yep. Gary Clark Jr. has won. Chris Stapleton picked up two that evening for Best Country Album and Best Country Solo Performance. And Bonnie Raitt has 10. And B.B. the King himself has 15.
Wow.
Yeah.
You can hear more blues-infused country music on Country Hits USA with Nikki Strong on VOA 1. You can also reach Nikki on social media at VOA Music on Facebook and VOA underscore music on Twitter. Thanks, Nikki.
You're welcome.
Thrill is gone. The thrill is gone away.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can always find us any time of the day or night at our website, voanews.com. We're also on Twitter. We invite you to follow us at VOA underscore IE. Our director is Tracy Carter. Our engineer is Chaz Hall. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington, and we thank you so much for spending part of your day with us. Come back again when you can. Have a super day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
2 years ago, after the Russian Federation occupied and attempted to annex Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula, the United States, the European Union, and a number of other countries and international organizations applied targeted sanctions against Russian individuals, businesses, and officials complicit in the Russian aggression against Ukraine. In response to Russia's continued aggression toward Ukraine, including training, arming, and fighting alongside separatists in eastern Ukraine, on July 31, 2014, the United States and the European Union initiated a new round of coordinated sanctions targeting certain sectors of the Russian economy. Sanctions are not an end unto themselves, said Secretary of State John Kerry at the 2016 Munich Security Conference. But we shouldn't forget why they were imposed in the first place: to stand up for Ukraine's fundamental rights, rights of international norms that have been accepted ever since World War II, that were part of what that great battle was about. The sanctions have taken a heavy toll on the Russian economy, contributing to a sharp depreciation of Russian currency and the country's current recession. Russia is a signatory to the September 2014 and February 2015 Minsk agreements, but Moscow has made no effort to fulfill even the first point, observing the ceasefire. Combined Russian separatist forces continue to launch daily attacks on Ukrainian government positions. Conditions for sanctions relief are clear. Russia has a simple choice: fully implement Minsk or continue to face economically damaging sanctions, said Secretary of State Kerry.
The path to sanctions relief is clear. Withdraw weapons and troops from the Donbas, ensure that all Ukrainian hostages are returned, allow full humanitarian access to occupied territories, which, by the way, is required by international law and by several United Nations resolutions, support free, fair, and internationally monitored elections in the Donbas under Ukrainian law, and restore Ukraine's control of its side of the international border, which belongs to it.
In other words, said Secretary of State Kerry, Russia can prove by its actions that it will respect Ukraine's sovereignty, just as it insists on respect for its own. Europe and the United States are going to continue to stand united, said Secretary of State Kerry, both in sustaining sanctions for as long as they are necessary and in providing needed assistance to Ukraine until the sovereignty and integrity of Ukraine is protected through the full implementation of the Minsk agreements.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. We'll be right back.
is